Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, online, kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com. Coming up on this Monday edition, Europe is changing its mind about immigration to some extent. Got a story about that for you. Also, the suburbs in the United States, they're changing quite a bit as well. A lot of different trends that are occurring. It affects where we live. And the most incredible life forms that NOAA found on its latest deep sea dive. Some pretty interesting creatures. We'll talk about that and more this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We're at KPCG. We do have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well and a kpcg.fm. And I'm Dwight Falk, and Abraham Blondeau is here today. How you doing, Abraham?
Doing pretty good.
Have a good weekend?
Yeah, it was really productive.
We've got some really interesting stories to talk about today. And one of the stories, of course, we always like to, I guess, comment briefly on the weather if it's sort of out of the ordinary. 84 degrees today, supposedly.
Yeah.
We'll see if we get there. But, I mean, what is this, March the 6th? That's pretty warm, unless you're living in Australia or somewhere.
Yeah, and it's pretty humid, too. It's not humid tornado type of weather, but it's still pretty humid, and the wind isn't cold. It's pretty warm, even though it's blowing pretty fast. So, yeah, it's just sometimes I just have to double-check my watch for the date because it just seems like we're already in April or later than that.
I've had that happen, strangely, where I've just kind of stopped and thought, what month are we in?
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's just unusual temperatures this year. So I think a lot of the country's feeling that. I guess the climate change people would point to climate change as a reason, but there's ups and downs, and we're definitely on an upswing. And I think it's going to be in the 70s most of the week, so it's we're heating up pretty quick. That lawn's looking at me, saying, are you going to mow me or what? And I thought I was hoping I wouldn't have to yet, but I might have to.
Yeah, mine. Well, we have a lot of neighbors who have outdoor cats and things, and the grass has been gradually disappearing from our front lawn. So I might not even have to mow it at all this year.
Well, there is that stretch in Oklahoma in the summer when it gets hot and dry a lot of times. You don't have to mow because it doesn't grow. My neighbor still does. He's an older man, he's retired. Doesn't probably have a lot else going on, I'm guessing. And he likes to mow, which is nice, but he'll mow. He'll mow it all the time. He'll mow the dirt. I'm like, what is he mowing? But he's out there mowing it. And he's got sprinklers. But the wind was so strong that they were on the other day, but they were just watering my lawn.
Yeah.
I thought, well, hey, thanks. He's a good neighbor. Appreciate that. Speaking of neighbors, some people aren't as friendly towards people coming in, and maybe for good reason. This is from the Associated Press, getting into some headlines today. Europe's trend: Austria, once open, now shows migrants the door. They were welcoming them in, and now they're saying, we want you out of here. Austria was among the first countries in Europe to put out the welcome mat when waves of people fleeing war and poverty reached the continent. Now its focus is showing them the door. Parliament is set to pass a law stripping pocket money, food, and shelter from those denied asylum, potentially leaving them on the street. So that revolving door is a lot unfriendlier, and when you're heading out, they're even taking pocket money from them.
Yeah, this is a pretty big turnaround, especially when I think late last year and the year before, Europe was heralded as the great liberal democracy, having all these people come in and allowing them, granting them asylum in most cases. But I think they're starting to realize the consequences of that policy. And while the policy was well-intentioned, there are lots of unintended consequences on your own people, security, economics, even voting demographics, all those different things. So it is real interesting to see if Europe can keep it up and if more countries become like Austria and if Europe can stay justified in criticizing American immigration policy when they're pretty much doing the same.
Angela Merkel's kind of one of the last holdovers or at least her group and that way of thinking where they have been letting people in. It seems like it's maybe shifting a little bit and is in Austria. The interior minister of Austria proudly touts figures showing Austria as the European Union's per capita leader in expelling those rejected. So they're proud about that, I guess, probably because the people want it. Austrian courts are toughening up, too. On Thursday, 8 Iraqi men were sentenced to prison for 13 years because of a gang rape of a German woman on New Year's Eve more than a year ago. So they're taking some action there. A survey of 10 EU member countries last month showed 65% of the 1,000 Austrian respondents favored stopping all immigration from Muslim nations. And only those from Poland scored higher at 71%. But in Poland, the government is pushing it more. Here, it's more, I think, of it's an outgrowth of the way the population feels. At least that's what they say in this write-up from the Associated Press. So they're not too happy with those Muslim nations, and they make a real point about that. So that's an issue here in the U.S. too. But in Europe, in Austria, they're saying no more.
Yeah, and it's I think it's easy to be critical of those nations, but let's keep in mind how small they are. Nations like Austria, Poland, even Germany, they're very small countries, especially compared to the United States. United States, we still have tons of land in order that we can use for many different purposes and reselling people. We have and much bigger infrastructure as well. Those small European countries, I mean, even just 100,000 immigrants could greatly change their entire demographics nationwide. And so they have to keep that in mind, and they're much more sensitive to it than the United States, which has 360 million people. That's just a drop in the bucket for the United States, but the Austria could greatly affect their entire lifestyle.
It's the mentality is changing. Europe is changing their thinking about immigration, particularly Austria at this time, and imagine there'll be more of that as we move forward. Here's an interesting story about the U.S. suburbs. They're changing quite a bit. I saw this yesterday. I went to Dallas briefly over the weekend. We were coming back through Gainesville, which is just a little bit north of Dallas. They have a mall there, a big outlet mall. And so the kids were excited to stop and get out of the car for a few minutes. I said, all right, well, let's stop at that outlet mall. And and as many of our listeners probably think to themselves right now, oh, there's nothing there anymore. I found that out yesterday. It's just a big vacant building. Went out of business. I had no way. Nobody told me. It was disappointing. We pulled in and it's like a ghost town, completely shut down. And it's sort of depressing when you see what used to be sort of a thriving area and there's nothing there anymore. And that's happening to some of these suburbs. So I saw it firsthand yesterday.
Yeah. I was in Dallas two years ago with my classmates at college. It was our end of college career trip. We call it senior trip.
Yeah.
And we went to Dallas. We went to Six Flags, then we went to go see a movie. And it wasn't in a bad neighborhood. It looked fine, but it was completely deserted. And we went inside. The theater was operating, but there was just like one person there. And then the rest of the mall was completely vacant. Like, the mall was open. You could walk around, but all the stores were closed or they were just empty because no one wanted to rent out the space. So it was odd just walking through a ghost town. There's just a janitor there, like, mopping the floor, and that's the only other people in the whole building.
Right, and a lot of it has to do with e-commerce. You know, people aren't as apt to go to a mall when you can find whatever you want pretty much online. And not that it's necessarily bad to see a mall not be there. I don't know. Sometimes the malls are good, sometimes they're not. But it does show you that things are changing. And the whole suburban experience is changing as well. They say the line, this is a write-up here from, I believe it was Associated Press as well, the line is blurring between the city and the suburb. It's changing. They say urban and suburban areas are becoming less distinguishable as modern populations value convenience and location over size. The line between the city and suburb has already started to blur, according to Fadi Massad, who's an urban planning professor at the University of Toronto. They have a book called Infinite Suburbia, and so he was talking to, this is Business Insider. So some people still attribute the oldest part of the city, which is predominantly pedestrian-friendly and more dense, as urban, and then everything else that starts going out further in distance from the core as suburban. But that definition doesn't work well any longer. He says what you would usually define as urban and suburban is eroding, so that line is changing. It is amazing. You can drive through bigger cities, and you drive for 20, 30, 40 miles, and it just all looks the same. You know, it's just strip mall, strip mall, strip mall, gas station. And you feel like I'm in this perpetual sort of suburbia, and I think that's kind of what he's talking about.
Yeah, that's a really good point he makes, and I think a lot of people, if they haven't been in a big city for a while, that a place they used to live and they revisit it, it's completely different because you have this hybrid of living space with business. Because before they were pretty separate, you had little local businesses, but now you have these huge industrial parks, huge malls, huge business areas, right beside apartments, right beside big fancy suburbs, and usually with public transport integrated somehow, so everyone can travel easily, and it's just this big sprawling urban jungle.
Yeah,
and it's convenient in a lot of ways, but you don't have that feeling where you can get away or be secluded. Like, I think that's what, when we think of suburb, that's what we think of. There's houses, but it's secluded from business.
Right.
Like, it's just houses you can kind of have a quiet space, but it's not like that anymore.
Yeah, they say urban planners across America are rethinking how suburbs are designed. Towns like New Rochelle, a suburb of New York City, are evolving to focus less on space and possession and more on walkability and environmental impact. And they go list a few ways here that these what used to be suburbs are being impacted. The value of the McMansions, as they call them, is way down. So hopefully you don't own a McMansion. This is kind of takes a shot at them, but it says that cheaply constructed, cheaply constructed. This is what they wrote. The cheaply constructed mansions of old are plummeting in value as home buyers become more discerning. In an article from August 2016, Bloomberg cited data from real estate site Truilla that showed that the premiums paid for McMansions have declined significantly in 85 of the country's 100 biggest cities. Aren't you glad you didn't buy that McMansion, Abraham?
Yes, yeah, I'm glad I spent it on Doritos instead.
They say, for the purpose of the study, the McMansion is defined as a home built between 2001 and 2007 that has between 3,000 and 5,000 square feet of space. It's a pretty big home, and you see a lot of those around. To cite one example, in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, the extra money that buyers were expected to be willing to pay to own a McMansion fell by 84% from 2012 to 2016. In that same city in 2012, a typical McMansion would be valued at $477,000, about 274% more than the area's other homes. Today, a McMansion would be valued at $611,000, or 190% above the rest of the market. So it has elevated, but it's not elevating at the same pace as the others. So, I mean, it's still not bad numbers. It still is increasing in value, but it's not valued the same way that it used to be.
Right. I think that's true for a lot of the, during that building boom where there were lots of houses going up everywhere, they've gone down in value. And we've seen, like in the neighborhood I live in, the property rates are actually rising, even though the quality isn't improving in most cases. So we're seeing a lot of the newer houses decrease and some of the older properties go up a little bit. And it's kind of reaching a median or like some kind of balance.
Yeah, it's always interesting how it seems like humans always try to go in extremes. Like people want to a lot of times live in the biggest house they can, or they want to live in the smallest. You know, the tiny house craze, like the size of a closet. People are like, I could live with this. And it's like, well, yeah, you could. But I mean, you're living in like a closet too. So, and then the prices on some of those are crazy. If you've ever lived at a tiny house. You know, they'll say like deluxe tiny house and it's about $75,000-$80,000.
Right.
And it's like a tiny little thing. It's nice enough, but for one person, but I'm like, well, for $80,000, that's a house, half of a house maybe, depending on where you live or a good down payment or something. And you can't resell it, I don't think. I hope none of our listeners are real big into the tiny houses. Not trying to offend anybody, but it just seems like a lot of money to put into something really tiny and movable.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And what this story kind of makes me think of is I think capitalism, especially the American economy, it's based off of private property, basically. That you can own your private property, your piece of land, your house, whatever it might be. It's yours, it's your possession. And so you want to generate income to provide for it, to improve it. And that's kind of the motivation. And with this new movement in housing prices and in suburbia and the urban landscape, I think it's depriving a lot of people from that private possession mindset. And I think that could really undermine our economy, because instead of people looking to have their own like miniature kingdom, if you can say, where you have your own house, your family can live there, you can give it to your children as inheritance or something like that, where it develops wealth for a long time, or at least it's an asset in the family for a long time. Now I think we're moving towards these smaller living accommodations that kind of undermine that foundational part of our economy, our lifestyle. And it's going to change it in a really significant way.
Yeah, and that it could. I don't know if, you know, obviously it's probably the economy that drives these things, but you also look at the breakdown of the family. You don't have the traditional family unit as often as they used to, because the idea of a neighborhood or a house is a family, right? And if you're not having the family stay together, why do you need the house? Why do you need the neighborhood? It's becoming a little more. If I could look at one thing in this whole trend of, say, it becoming more of this urban sprawl, it'd be more individual, right? I mean, it's set up more for the individual that can move quickly, can go here, can go there, do what they want, have conveniences. What about the kids, though? Like, what about the yard for the kids, and what about those things? So I think the family unit maybe is, maybe because that's suffering, maybe it's changing some things too.
Yeah, it's a really good point, and I think it really does accommodate a younger lifestyle, like the exciting distractions for teenagers and young couples and generational people, Generation X, I guess, who are younger, and they grew up in a certain lifestyle where they're more independent and they can go do their own thing. And I think that's what this is really accommodating compared to making a big investment on a house. And pretty much once you make that investment, you're tied to it.
Yeah, you are. It's a huge thing. And here are some of the other areas that are being affected because of this change in the suburban lifestyle. As mentioned, suburban malls are in crisis. Anchor stores like Macy's, Sears, JCPenney, they're closing hundreds of locations, as we've talked about. The commercial real estate from CoStar estimates that nearly a quarter of malls in the U.S., or roughly 310 of the nation's 1,300 shopping malls, are at high risk of losing one of the big anchor stores. Once you lose those, you're kind of, you know it's not as prevalent to have one. Even outlet malls, they kind of need a couple of anchor stores, you know, like a Nike or something. And if those go, no one's going to stop at Williams-Sonoma.
Right.
I don't think that's an anchor store. I was trying to think of a smaller one, but you need those big anchor stores. So suburban malls are in crisis, as we've seen. Companies are packing up and heading to the city, moving more of their headquarters there. And so that's an issue as well. And McDonald's, Kraft Heinz, and Conagra Foods have all left the leafy suburbs and moved into downtown in Chicago. So you see the businesses moving also.
Yeah, and that's a big switch. I think even we talked about with Detroit, and where we've seen suburbs go vacant because of prices and a poor economy, but where you have the businesses do bring wealth. They bring infrastructure. They make the city councils focus on those areas to improve them for business. And when they move to one area, it's easy for those suburbs to be neglected,
right?
Because they don't bring in the income.
Right. And, you know, I guess ideally it'd be nice if you were going to live in a suburb to have a company out of the city, not necessarily in your suburb, but you could get there quickly. But now if you got to go downtown, you probably don't want to live out in the suburb because it'd take you a long time to get there. They say also the roads that connect suburbs to the city are falling apart. Roads are falling apart a lot of places.
Yeah.
President Trump has talked about the infrastructure needed, and I think he's right, but where does the money come from? I mean, there are a lot of roads out there, and even the interstates have issues. But at least there you've got the money, I suppose, in most cases, to try to fix them up, the main ones. But the roads to the neighborhoods, they can be pretty choppy at times.
Well, yeah, in in the neighborhood I live in, not to degrade the county that it's a part of, but there are probably some craters on the moon would be embarrassed at some of the potholes in the neighborhood. And it's just because it's old, and the income is put towards new projects or other more important roads. And that's just the way it is. And that's true in a lot of neighborhoods where there just isn't the tax revenue or the focus put on those small little residential roads.
Another issue with the suburbs drying up or changing, golf courses are shutting down. It used to be a celebrated pastime, but today many of the country's golf courses are on the brink of shutting down or have closed already. Over 800 golf courses have shuttered across the U.S. in the past decades. The interest in the 18 to 30-year-old range is very limited, and so people aren't golfing, so your golf courses are closing down. And the last thing that's in crisis, they say, is casual dining. That's not like what it used to be. So a lot of business is affected by the changing landscape.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this will affect the next few years, because I think a lot of companies will have to make pretty quick decisions on their strategy and how to minimize losses. And so we could see a pretty significant shift where even if a lot of people don't want to do the new way of things, we'll have to because most companies are adapting quickly.
Yeah, I mean, even that example of that mall there in Gainesville, Texas, it closed down, but you had other businesses near it because obviously they thought we're going to have good traffic here. There's an Applebee's. It's still open, but why would you go there if the mall's closed? There's hotels next to it, but why would you stay at that hotel? There's nothing there other than that mall, which is vacant. And that's a pretty lonely stay, right? If you stay at a hotel and you look out the window and you see a ghost mall.
Yeah.
So it affects all those businesses down the line. Suburbs are changing, and it's changing a lot of these companies. And the family's changing, too. Pretty fascinating study, I think.
Yeah, I think a big lesson to learn from all this is that nothing's monocausal. And just how family and business and roads and infrastructure all interweaves into this big web of American society, and that it all impacts everything. And I think especially with when you look at the nuclear family, the traditional family, that's really the starting point. And that's really what sends the most shockwaves across all these different trends we've been talking about.
Speaking of a nuclear family, yesterday when I was driving, I saw an SUV with the atomic symbol on the door. And I thought, what? Why? Why is that on that door? Like, did they just think it was neat and it was their own paint job? Is it part of some company or something? Are they carrying weapons? I've never seen that before. Have you ever seen that on a vehicle?
No.
Is it powered by nuclear energy?
Nuclear-powered Suburban. I've never seen that before.
Strange. Yeah, I saw it just around town, and I thought, I didn't know. I was trying to discern whether it was some sort of a government agency or if it was just the guy thought it was cool to put that on his car. Can you do that? I suppose there's certain things you couldn't put on your vehicle. You can't get it painted like a squad car, right? The official stuff put on there just because you think it looks neat. So, yeah, that was strange. I've never seen that before, and not sure what that was.
Yeah, I think the funniest one I've seen, and not in person, but just on the internet, is someone made these big balloons. You attach them to the back of your car, and they float up, and they're shaped like missiles. So when you drive down the road, it looks like missiles are chasing you.
Uh-oh.
As you're driving.
That's kind of funny. I was behind a guy heading down to Texas, and appropriately enough, it was a pickup truck, and hanging at the back of his truck, like pretty low on the ground, were two cowboy boots. A pair of boots back there. I just thought, that seems almost unsafe. Like, if it flew off and it hit the car behind you or something, they were just like dragging.
Huh.
I don't think there was anybody in them.
Yeah.
And they weren't dragging on the ground, but I mean, they weren't that far off the ground. They were maybe, I don't know, a foot. And I thought, maybe he needs them. Maybe it's like quick getaway, jump into the boots or something. But that was unusual too. You see some interesting things when you're on the interstate.
Yeah, some people store things in very interesting ways, or they just forget that they're even there.
That's true. That's true too. Or you find yourself behind somebody that's moving, and they just got a bunch of stuff in their pickup, and it's kind of bungeed down, but you're not sure if it'll.
Yeah.
And then there's always the odd individual that wants to go like 50 in the 75.
Right.
I don't know, if they're having car problems or what, but you just think, what's going on there? It's always, it can be dangerous if you go too slow. People aren't expecting it. So we talked the other week about this new gold rush out in California. They need people to harvest the dead trees. And you can get paid a lot for that. Well, here's a reason why. A tree falls and kills a woman at National Park in California. Don't know if it was a dead one or not, but officials say a 21-year-old woman was killed by a falling tree at Half Dome Village in Yosemite National Park. It was a windy, cold storm sweeping through Northern California that dumped hail, scattered showers, and then some wind. So she got killed. They closed the park and then reopened it. It happens, not that often, but what an odd way to die. Just hit by a tree in a national park.
Yeah. I mean, anytime people go out in nature, I guess there's always a chance that something like that could happen. Animal, a tree, or any kind of freak accident, yeah. I guess. But especially as the forests get older, there's the chance increases for that to happen. So it's good they're getting rid of all those trees, but forest fires are supposed to do that. That's kind of like a right. cycle. But when you have people living in the forest, you can't allow that to happen. So it's an interesting problem for conservation.
Yeah, you'd hope you could. Maybe she didn't see it coming. I mean, you'd hope you could get out of the way, but I suppose maybe it's a huge tree or you didn't see it or you panicked. You're not sure which way to go. And it raises an interesting question. I've thought about this occasionally. If you could know how you would die, would you want to know that? Is that information you'd want to know? And I don't mean like you got sick and you know in 2 weeks you'll die of something, but I mean like way ahead. Is that information you'd want to know?
I know that's a good question. I think some people would, especially if they're maybe involved in more dangerous jobs or something. But I think if you did know, it would make you pretty paranoid. Anytime you're approaching a similar situation, you'd probably freak out. Or
right.
Maybe that's the reason why it happened in the first place.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just an interesting question.
I've thought of that, I wouldn't want to know, because particularly if you didn't know the timing, you know, you'd always be worried about the event. Here's a case where a woman does know how she's going to die. A woman describes living a life knowing exactly how she's going to die. She's a woman with a genetic defect so rare, doesn't even have a name yet. 42-year-old Jocelyn Linder is a carrier of what's known as orphan gene. Have you heard of that, orphan gene?
I don't think so.
Yeah. It's a genetic defect that usually has fatal consequences. Only 14 people have ever had this condition, and they're all related to her. And wow. 5 of them have died from it. So that's some information she's got to carry around.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. Well, it's also tragic, too, that they don't really know, I guess, how it was started or what caused it and how to treat it or anything.
They're looking for ways to solve it. Her father died of the condition at 49, and she's 42. His autopsy revealed that after years of pooling of fatty lymph, which is the lymph liquid, his organs had essentially fused together. That's what happens. So he just swelled up and he died. A year later, Linder and her sister, Hillary, were tested for the disorder. The results came back positive for both of them. So she says, there are days I have to force off my fears, in order to get out of bed. But then she says, there are days when I know that being this near death reminds me of how much I love life, and it makes every part of every day something I am joyously grateful for. So she has her ups and downs. That'd be really hard information to carry around, knowing that you were going to die probably of this, you know, but you just don't know when. That would be really tough, I think.
Yeah, no, it reminds me a really peculiar story. I forget what book it was in that I read. But it was in the war in India, I believe, or Afghanistan, one of the two. And I think it's somehow related to Winston Churchill. Either he knew the man or same, like a contemporary. But basically, he had a dream one night of how he died, like the time of day, the date, how he, like the circumstances of the battle. And he wrote it down in his diary and he told all his friends about it. And that's actually how he died. Like, it was exactly the same. Like, it was just very eerily similar.
Same date and everything?
Yeah. Like, because his dream was in the future. And he died even in the same circumstances of the battle as he remembered in his dream. Hmm. And he told all his friends about it. So it's just a bizarre case of something like that.
I've heard of that, actually. I think it might even have been, like, somebody I was related to, but that they had a dream that they were going to die in a certain way, and I think about 2 weeks later they did. So I don't know why that happens, but interesting story and hard to carry that knowledge around. We all know we're going to die, but we don't think about it too much usually, which is good, or we wouldn't get anything done. So on a lighter note, of course, this one happened. Police find an antique-looking gun on a guy, and people think he's a time traveler. This is in Baltimore. The police department posted a photo of a gun on his Facebook and Twitter accounts Thursday, after it was seized from a 36-year-old man during a traffic stop. police found some other things, and anyway, he's not a great guy. Had some issues, but it's a pretty regular crime story, except that the gun is like something out of the Civil War, and it was like a working gun he had on him. It was like an old time gun from many years ago.
Yeah, that's really neat. I know you can buy those at certain places. I think someone I know, their father had an old, basically like a musket, yeah, like a breech loading gun, and those are always neat to see, but you never see them. People carry them around because they're like antiques.
Yeah, but he had it like something he may use. So, of course, the internet had a lot of fun with it. A couple of the comments were, was he attempting to assassinate Lincoln? Because it was such an old gun. And then my favorite is actually from the Baltimore Police Department. They jumped on board too, and they wrote this. If it pleases the court, we will ensure we safeguard this firearm and ensure the safety of all in the village of Lord Baltimore. Whilst this young lad possessed this weapon illegally, his punishment shall not include that of public stoning nor shaming. He therefore shall be recommended as a candidate for reenactment just up the road in Gettysburg. To try to write it in old-timey English.
Yeah.
He was not going to be publicly stoned or shamed. Well, he kind of was shamed, but he didn't get publicly stoned.
Yeah. Well, I think for the police, especially in the rash of weapons being used against them, I don't think they'd mind this one because I think it takes about 2 minutes to load it. So right. Even if he got one shot off, he can probably get him at before he fires a second one.
Yeah, how odd. What an odd weapon to have, but kind of neat for those that like old guns and stuff. It's pretty cool looking. The Key of David program is coming up here in a bit on Trumpet Radio, also the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury, back today from Edstone, England. A lot of great programming here today on KPCG, including Watch Jerusalem, Just the Best Literature, and Music for Life. And so that's all coming your way here on KPCG today. And you're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here at 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk and Abraham Blondeau here today as well, refreshed after the weekend. And enjoying these balmy conditions, mid-80s. And, yeah, I should have worn my tank top today. I went with the long-sleeve dress shirt instead.
Yeah, thankfully for me, you didn't wear.
Yeah, well, hey, I don't know how to take that. Probably not well, I guess. Yeah. We did want to note Music for Life is a pre-concert talk in relation to a concert that's coming up this Thursday. It's March the 9th at 7:30 p.m. That'll be at Armstrong Auditorium just down the road if you're listening in the local area at 101.3. Check it out. You can go to armstrongauditorium.org and get tickets. And if you're not in the local area, well, maybe you can come. There's a few days. Make the trip. It's the National Symphony Orchestra of Ukraine. I have a hard time saying that for some reason. The National Symphony Orchestra of Ukraine. Like when they run together, it's like a tongue twister. It shouldn't be, but I struggle with that one.
Yeah, no, I have a tendency of making almost every English word a tongue twister. So.
National Symphony. I think there's something about that. I have a hard time with it. They play much better than I can say it. So make sure you come out and see them. It's going to be a really great, great show. They're the leading symphonic organization of Ukraine and the most recorded orchestra located in any former Soviet territory. It's always amazing some of these acts come through Armstrong Auditorium, the Russian Ballet, and other places. And I just wonder what their life is like. You know, they live in a very different part of the world. And yet we can come together and enjoy their talent, which is really amazing, whether it's music or dance. But you think, what's their life like? You know, they grew up completely different than me. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, well, like most of these individuals, I mean, their ages probably vary, but they did grow up under Soviet rule or in the shadow of it, at least. And even now, they're facing Russian aggression on their eastern border. So I mean, even today, that hasn't gone away. And so I think when you have individuals like that, they just have a lot of unique characteristics they do bring to music, and even in their performances, too.
It's a universal thing. We can appreciate the music. We can appreciate the dance. And it's so amazing when you can see people that are very different from you because they're from a different location. Yet they're presenting this really beautiful piece of music or dance, and everyone's enjoying it. And you think, but people fight each other. You know, there's wars between nations, and yet it doesn't have to be that way. But so it's a nice break from that unfortunate reality in the world.
Yeah, well, I think music reminds us of what the human spirit is capable of, and it's not something that's violent. It's something very beautiful. And even yesterday in the bookstore, there was a book called "The Siege of Leningrad." The battle and the orchestra, because during that siege, the people starved to death. It was one of the most terrible events of World War II. But the orchestra would play music and put on loudspeakers so the Germans could hear them, just saying that we're not going to become animals just because you're starving us to death. And it's just a very powerful example of how music can really impact people.
Pretty amazing stories there. Here is a historical one you've got for us, Abraham, and it's looking at some lessons of the past to learn about some things today, and comparing the Iran nuclear deal and the diplomacy we have with Iran in general with the Paris Peace Conference in 1972 between the U.S. and Vietnam. What can we learn from that past peace conference that would relate to the situation today?
Yeah, this is, I think, a really interesting parallel because although it's, I mean, every comparison eventually breaks down, there are some very powerful lessons here, especially dealing with a nation that you haven't conquered, that you're trying to make a deal with, and someone who is so obviously antagonistic towards you, that the peace deal is just a charade. And I think most people would admit that with Iran, that they'll make deals, but they still have an agenda that they're going to pursue no matter what the peace treaty says. And so with Vietnam, obviously a conflict that has a lot of memories with it, bad memories. And this is a lot more complicated than there's a lot more layers to it than I'll talk about today. But the main lesson I want to talk about is that Americans haven't learned the lessons of diplomacy over their history. And that is that in most cases, American presidents and governments will make a peace deal that is politically expedient, but has very little benefit to the people it impacts in the area. So with Vietnam, terrible conflict between the North and the South. Vietnam's right next to the Pacific Ocean, south of China, next to Laos, Cambodia, and Thailand. So in that Southeast Asia area. The Vietnamese threw off French rule in 1954. And so you had a northern part that was firmly communist. They border with China. So China would send them supplies and money and military equipment. And you had the southern government that was more allied with the United States. It wasn't democratic necessarily. The leader wasn't that great of a guy, but in the Cold War, it was a good way to prop up against communist aggression. And so when Vietnam began, it was a very terrible war, guerrilla tactics, just a lot of terrible violence. And the media, probably the first time the media really inaccurately reported the war, where they made the communists appear victorious when most of the times they were crushed by the American army and by the South Vietnamese. But it made, to most Americans, it made America look like that we were losing when we were actually winning in a big way. And the media refused to really change the reports because most of them were anti-war.
Right.
And especially against Johnson and Nixon, two presidents.
Yeah, which was a huge change in and of itself. If you look at World War II and the newsreels they would play before movies, it was always very pro-U.S., trying to highlight the positive, but Vietnam was a change in that. Maybe before then even, but specifically Vietnam, where every night of the nightly news, it was just, they kept bringing the war into your living room in a pretty negative way, and it changed the morale of the country. And of course, it's continued to this day whenever we get into a conflict.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you can really peg the media here for forcing the U.S. government to seek a peace treaty when it wasn't necessary and when they probably shouldn't have done it. Because they're forcing a peace treaty in circumstances where they wouldn't get anything out of it. Like there was no winnable situation for them from concessions, especially with an enemy that wouldn't concede anything. But because they forced public opinion by their reports, it really forced the government to act unwisely.
Yeah, exact same thing with Iran. Same thing in the Middle East with the Palestinians. Israel's not weak. They don't need to make some peace treaty. But the pressure and the opinion has forced them to just give away. U.S. has made the same thing with Iran. We had no reason to make a peace deal with them in any way. We probably should have gone and dealt more severely with them. But, isn't that America's great weakness, I guess, and Israel in the Middle East and Britain? this just anything for peace, and we just surrender little by little by little to people that have no intention of having peace with us.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what Herbert Armstrong said, that America usually wins on the battlefield, but we lose the war, the battle for peace, because a lot of it just stems from trying to please the public when either they're wildly misinformed or they're too short-sighted. They want the immediate relief of war, when if we persevered a bit longer, especially in Iraq with the surge, if we didn't pull out, ISIS never would have happened.
Right.
And look at the calamity in the world today. But anyway, getting back to Vietnam, the big turning point in the war was a Tet Offensive in January 30, 1968, when the North Vietnamese attacked. They were crushed, but the media reported as a communist victory. And so that really forced Lyndon Johnson to seek a ceasefire, some negotiations, which they did begin in 1968. So in 1968 was really the first year where they had these peace talks in Paris. Associated with this is the allegation that Nixon sent someone to undermine them until he was elected in 1969. I'm not going to get into that, but that's a very controversial point in this. But in any event, the peace treaties failed in 1968. Nixon won, and in 1969, he tried to make a deal, but it didn't go on, or it never worked for a while. And so the war continued, kept dragging out. But they did come back to the negotiating table in 1972. But what's interesting about this is that Kissinger would have secret talks with his North Vietnamese counterpart. And the U.S. government was certain that North Vietnamese were wanting to make a deal. The whole time in 1972 when they were trying to strike this deal to end the war, to turn public opinion back on their side, the North Vietnamese were planning the Easter Offensive. And the whole point of that offensive was to get to push the border south of North Vietnam, so when the peace treaty was struck, they would dominate South Vietnam. So basically, it would be a peace treaty, quote-unquote, but North Vietnam would dominate South Vietnam so much that when the U.S. left under the peace treaty, they would basically control Vietnam. So this whole time that the U.S. is negotiating with Vietnam, Vietnam is planning this. Vietnam doesn't want to end the conflict. They're not going to give South Vietnam any credence as a government. Their whole point is conquest and to conquer South Vietnam. And it's that attitude, that idea that we can make a peace treaty with a nation that's going to conquer. That's the same thing we see with Iran today, where we make this Iran nuclear agreement, but they're clearly trying to conquer the Middle East, expand their hegemony, and use nuclear weapons. And they're even doing that, I think, on the Trump Hour last week, talked about them using right. North Korea as a to develop their nuclear weapons program.
Yeah, and we've seen it play out, like you say, there in Vietnam, and we've seen it play out more recently in the Middle East. I think that would probably be on everybody's mind even more, where it's just been this constant, you know, peace, 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 and but there's no stopping of the aggressiveness. I mean, Arafat, what was it, the Oslo Accords, I think it was, where,
yes.
You know, they gave all these, you know, agreements, and Arafat's sitting there getting them to cause more problems and more problems, and to be the instigators over there in Israel. And yet somehow a lot of the public opinion is that it's Israel's fault when they're being attacked constantly by the Palestinians. And so we see the same thing happening here in the U.S. with this Iran deal, but except the stakes here are a lot greater here, because we're talking about a power that in Iran that does want to dominate the world, or at least bring it to its end, and that's what they want, and doing so with nuclear weapons. So it's the danger is much higher than it's ever been.
Yeah, exactly. With North Vietnam, they're a small power. They weren't an existential threat to the United States, so it wasn't a big... For Nixon and his successors, it wasn't a big deal to sacrifice South Vietnam to North Vietnam, because in the big scheme of things, the communists would win another victory, yes, but it wouldn't change the balance of power in a great way. With Iran, it's a lot different, because they're in a position where they control oil, the oil trade flow, but also with nuclear weapons, they can even hit Europe, they can destroy Israel, they can hit a lot of key allies. For the United States, very important trade routes in the Middle East. So the stakes are a lot higher, like you said. And we're seeing the same scenario play out where we make a deal expecting them to honor it when they're actually just it's allowing them to conquer even more in the long run.
Yeah, and they don't do a good job of pretending either, especially Iran. They don't they don't care. They're pretty bold. So that's really interesting history there from Vietnam. And, of course, we see the same thing playing out today with the way we're trying to have peace treaties. We've got a few minutes left. We've got an interesting story here about some of the amazing sea life that has been found. NOAA had their latest deep sea dive, and they found some incredible life forms. Related to that, before we get into that, surgeons, according to Fox News, removed 915 coins swallowed by a Thai sea turtle. So there's a lot of amazing things down there, and sometimes they get a hold of things from man, including coins. And this turtle, I guess he likes shiny things. 915. So that's a lot. I don't know how much it was worth. I don't know what kind of coins they were, but did he jingle when he walked? You'd have to wonder. Could he swim? I don't know.
He sunk like a rock because of all the metal.
I don't know. Wow, 915 coins. But that was just astounding. But this is pretty fascinating here from Gizmodo.com. The most incredible life forms. What did they find when they went on their deep sea dive?
Yeah, NOAA, it's this Okeanos Explorer. They've been doing a series of deep sea dives in the Pacific around the Samoan Islands, the Marshall Islands, Solomon Islands, over there just northeast of Australia. And they found some pretty incredible things. Animals and organisms you would never even expect to exist underwater. And so I really encourage the viewers, if you're really, or listeners, if you're really excited about this, to go check out the images, because my word explanations don't really do it justice. But some of the things they have found in this deep sea in the tropical ocean, they found this a Venus flytrap sea anemone. Basically, it's a sea anemone that looks like a Venus flytrap. But underwater, it has a mouth and it. It's pink in the picture they have, and it closes on its prey, and it has little spikes that shoot venom into its the things it's trying to catch.
Sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah,
if you get caught by it. Yeah, it's always amazing. Every time they kind of look around down there, I mean, they always come across things that just haven't been seen before. You just have to wonder what else is out there and down there, especially under the water.
Yeah, especially the ones I always fascinated by is the really deep sea where there's no sunlight, and you see these amazing animals that light up themselves, and and sometimes they look pretty terrifying.
Yeah.
As well. but some of the other things they found, there's some really interesting anemones, and then ocean starfish and different things like that, and even this little UFO looking jellyfish. Mm. It's completely see-through, has a little gold ring around it, and it just floats everywhere. It looks like a UFO, like something you'd see in a movie.
Maybe it is a UFO. Yeah. That's where they all are. They're all under the water. Yeah, it's always amazing the stuff that they find down there. That would be a pretty fun project to be part of, just to say, hey, let's see what we found. You know? And I mean, even you know, in the Bible, like say, especially in the Book of Job, there's different animals mentioned that are a little unusual, and of course, commentaries have their thoughts on them that they're just expressed in an interesting way, but it's something we're familiar with. I don't know exactly, but. You do have to wonder, you know, we don't know everything that's out there or down under the oceans. And so it is amazing. And, you know, especially if you're coming at it from the point of view of there being a creator, just the genius and putting this together and making sure it all works and making these little creatures. I mean, somebody had to think it out. It's really pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Well, to me, that's why the deep sea creatures are the most fascinating, because it's impossible for a creature to evolve to not need light. And to withstand the intense pressure of being miles under the ocean. Humans can only develop submarines and equipment that can withstand that pressure. But these little fish can swim around their whole lifetime for probably hundreds, thousands of years. And they were created to do that. And it's just really neat to see, if you do look at it from the perspective of a creator, the problem solving and the habitats that were created to exist without light, without the normal circumstances of life. But there was a way found to do it. And it was a very innovative, amazing way that no one ever would have thought of, like a human never would have thought of. because some mind greater than a human came up with the idea in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, man's come up with some pretty amazing technology, but then there are basic things that we just can't solve. Another one above ground that I've heard about is how trees can suck water all the way up to the top. We can't replicate that, at least not that I've heard of, because a straw that high, it would collapse on itself, the pressure. You know, something very common and basic like that, and they still can't replicate how it's done.
Right.
So the technology is pretty astounding, no matter where you look, especially when you look at the creation itself.
Yeah, well, even I think scientists still can't really explain how birds can fly, like the physics of how the wings push air. I think they're made some big advancements on it. Maybe they have. I'm speaking on outdated information, but we didn't know for hundreds of years. Like, people would put these owls and birds in wind chambers and look at how their wings move, and we had no idea how they functioned, how they created lift, and all that. But someone did.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the dinosaurs learning how to fly millennia ago.
Well, you know, it's so interesting about that when you look at the creation and you see things technologically that we cannot do. But then at the same time, most people think, they know how to live, you know, we know how to live our lives. We don't need anybody to tell us anything. And, you know, we know how to define a family, or we know how to do this, that, or the other without anybody telling us. We'll figure it out, and yet we can't figure out how a tree works or how, you know, and again, maybe they've made more discoveries on that, but there's so many things, and like you're pointing out from this write-up, just things we don't know about, we don't understand. And so maybe we don't understand everything we think we do sometimes.
Yeah, it's, I think the human race would benefit a lot by asking ourselves what we don't know. And maybe looking to the good source to find out what we should know.
Yeah, really fascinating. You can check this out at gizmodo.com. Here are the latest incredible life forms NOAA found on its latest deep sea dive. It's worth checking out. And again, you kind of have to see the pictures to really appreciate it. But really awesome. Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Kia David coming up. Also, Just the Best Literature and Music for Life today. Make sure you listen for all of that. And that'll do it for us here on Trumpet Radio Live on this balmy Monday. For myself, Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondo, have a great rest of your Monday. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.